This could be quite a short time. Feels really spread out, sort of landscape. This could be really, really short because I'm not all that sure what it is that I do, to be honest. Someone asked me the other day, so what do you do? And I said, well, being an industrial chaplain is kind of a bit like the art of doing as little as possible, to be honest. I was up at Barrow Island just this week and travelling around various sites, and I went to a place where they were having trouble because some people had failed to realise that the tidal conditions and the choppiness of the water meant that a vessel that was probably costing about $250,000 a day to keep on the water was not able to be unloaded. I just want to check in. Is it all right if I say a rude word? Like, because I won't if it's not okay. Okay, because I just wanted to quote someone, that's all. And I introduced myself as a chaplain. And he turned around and he said, you've got to be joking. I said, yeah, I'm the chaplain. He said, what the fuck do we need a chaplain for? And I sort of said, well, if you knew the answer to that question, what would it be? And he said, geez, I don't know. Some sort of spiritual guidance or something, but I reckon you're probably too late. So it's both challenging and actually invigorating and quite beautiful to have the trust of a company that does transport and logistics to just turn up and be there and see what happens. And I like the fact they take the risk of employing me to do that. I'm going to just start. Might finish with a Bible reading because we've just heard that one from Paul, but I'd like to just start with some words written by John O'Donoghue, who's a recently deceased man, but deeply rooted in both his Christianity and his Celtic origins. I love what he writes. And I'll just read something that he's written here. Silence is the sister of the divine. And quoting Meister Eckhart, there is nothing in the world that resembles God so much as silence. Silence is a great friend of the soul. It unveils the riches of solitude. It's very difficult to reach that quality of inner silence. You must make a space for it so that it may begin to work for you. Further on, one of the tasks of true friendship is to listen compassionately and creatively to the hidden silences. Often secrets are not revealed in words. They lie concealed in the silence between the words or in the depth of what is unsayable between two people. In modern life, there's an immense rush to express. Sometimes the quality of what is expressed is superficial and immensely repetitive. A greater tolerance of silence is desirable. That fecund, that is, that's what I'm looking for, the fertile, yeah. That fecund silence, which is the source of our most resonant language. The depth and substance of a friendship mirrors itself in the quality and shelter of the silence between two people. So often I find myself noticing the silence far more than the words. Probably before I start talking about the ministry of accompaniment, which is, I think, a good way of describing what pastoral presence is, whether that's done in an industrial setting or anywhere else. It occurs to me that just about everything I've done in my life, it's probably the same for you, somehow has become a resource for me as I've grown older. And one of the things that I've done in my life is I've been a photographer with the newspaper for 25 years. And often stories come up from my past that help me understand why it is I'm doing what I'm doing or what it is that I'm hearing. And one of the stories that I heard quite often or experienced quite often was being with the football player who just had the injury. And I remember as a young man experiencing two types of pain in terms of the person. And one was the pain that the person physically felt. But the other was the pain that they felt because someone had just told them that their career was over. And they thought as a young person that their purpose for being on the planet had been taken away from them. So that sits with me. And that longing for purpose. The other little story that I recall is I've had the opportunity to meet people who have survived things. And one old guy that I met had survived being a prisoner of war on the Burma Railway during the Second World War. And in that space, naturally, I asked, how did you survive? And he said, well, I woke up every day and reminded myself that my purpose was to survive that day. And I remember him putting he said, I had to make up a good enough reason to live that was stronger than the reason to die. And he put his hand there and said, and I had to carry it in there. And again, a story about purpose. How somehow the purpose was what carried the guy. There's a similarity, this is a bit of a tangent, but there's a similarity with photography itself and what I do now. Like a lot of photographers, I was a frustrated, I would have loved to be a National Geographic nature photographer. And when I wasn't taking photos, particularly when I was stationed up north, I used to find things like osprey's nests and I'd go and lie on a rock for hours and wait. And so these pictures haven't translated well into JPEGs. They were from old black and white prints and one of them doesn't work at all. But see if I can just bring it up. So this is up somewhere between Karratha and Port Hedland. Try and make it. So I love doing this sort of stuff. It's out of whack there. But that's an osprey coming back with food to give its chick. And the thing that one's not translated well at all, I'll blank it out. You can turn the lights back on. The thing I love about nature photography is that it's not contrived. What else can you imagine it's like to be a nature photographer? I'm sure we've all taken pictures of things in the bush and that. Patience. Sorry? Patience. Patience, absolutely. The thing I love about it as well, Tyson, is that the subject determines the outcome. I don't get to drive the outcome visually of the picture. I can only try and get what's happening. There's a quietness. You can't be noisy. And there's a singularity of focus and thought. In fact, lying on a rock with a camera is quite a meditative thing because you start to hear yourself breathing and feeling your heart beating. And thoughts are just meandering through your head. It's quite meditative. And there's just no way that you can coerce nature to do what you want it to do. As we saw in those horrific images earlier, you know. Man lives within, not forcing. And there's a deep, deep authenticity about it. So anyway, that I think those sort of words that are captured in that sense, I think, is stuff that I capture in what it is to be a chaplain. And I'm very thankful to Doug Bridge, who came along last week, because he pretty much defined what it is to be a chaplain. I don't need to repeat that stuff. I'm also grateful that I belong to you, Mob, because you constantly demonstrated to me what it is to be a pastoral presence for each other. And some of us get up and talk about it, others just do it. And I'm really grateful to be amongst us. I remember Rose Petroni when she spoke. Where are you, Rose? Oh, okay. She spoke a couple of years ago about the fact that she went to work basically to serve others and to do her job as well. And I remember that. I remember, Peter, I remember your talk some short time ago where you were talking about prayer and just the simplicity of asking that God's will be done. I really valued what Ian Robertson shared with us. So my sense about pastoral presence is that we all do it when we relate to one another without judgment, without coercion, without diagnosing, without prescribing, without fixing or trying to fix, without correcting the other person or setting them straight. And if we can truly be with another person without doing these things, we can accompany them in a way that doesn't look after our needs, but honours theirs. Because if I require another person to comply with my assessments, then I run the risk of using my time in my service, not theirs. If I accompany another, I don't presume myself to be a dispenser of God or to sanction another's relationship with God, or to presume that I in some way are the creator or the facilitator of God's presence. I'm not the creator. That won't surprise anyone here. I'm not the creator, I'm the partaker of God's presence. I don't make God's presence possible. I merely show up. And in connecting with another, I find myself in God's presence. And it bowls me over pretty much every day. And I find that if I stop, listen, honour the highest thought, the inner wisdom, that I find God emerging within the other. I don't require another person to believe in God or to share any belief of mine. Belief is a construction. If I create a belief, it must be argued for, defended, protected, set beneath my own flag of personal righteousness. By not creating a belief, I have nothing to defend. It could get tricky for me here, what I'm about to say, but I think it is dangerous to believe. Can be that when I believe, I can belittle God. I don't know if that came out well. But anyway, what I really mean is, if I bring God down to the scope of my cognitive ability and my acuity in the form of a held belief, God ceases to be God, starts to be my construct. I cease to be the creation, become the creator. So I hold that tension as I go into pastoral presence. Because it's important to remember I'm not the creator. And I sit in that mystery. And it's important for me to be able to let go of that as well. So when I let go of the temptation to set God's agenda, to judge his people, I can let go of the temptation to relate to God as the one who fulfills my will, rather than imagine myself as the fulfillment of God's will. So it's an interesting place to sit in. But I feel that it gives me enormous freedom as I minister to people in a pastoral setting, because I can simply experience God's presence without feeling any need to create it. And to live without need is to live without lack, I believe. See, I do believe things. I don't know. Well, I did say I don't know at the beginning. As the great man from New Norcia, Placid, used to say, I could be wrong. doing pastoral studies, CPE, etc., the 101 question is that you're supposed to ask your own. So how does it feel? It's a shame Christy isn't here, because she's had a lot of people come up to her over the years and say, "So Christy, how are you? How does it feel?" And she laughs about it. But anyway, that's the basic question, is allow people to talk about feelings. So if I could turn that question back on me and ask, so how does it feel like to be an industrial chaplain? It feels like I belong, but I don't necessarily fit. It's about being conscious of and prepared to be out of equilibrium, which is actually interesting because our bodies are designed for equilibrium. At the moment, my body's trying to maintain 97.5 degrees or whatever it is. Is that right? No, 36.5 degrees, sorry, in the new speak. Yep, it's busy sort of, my guts are absorbing things and doing things and equilibrium is taking place without me being aware of it. And probably when I laugh at my own embarrassment, it's me trying to stay in equilibrium. But somehow being in the pastoral presence is about being aware of a lack of equilibrium and being prepared to sit with it in order for something different to happen. And here I shall quote Ian Robinson, who writes about desert spirituality. He says in part of his book about going out to the desert, "This is a good time to say with the ancients that the key to this is to let discomfort be your teacher. We learn little or nothing from our comfort zones. We learn little from the distress of being a survivalist. But the art of life is to return and remain in the zone where some discomfort continues to call forth our need of grace and attentiveness." Love that quote. Probably the most important stage on my path thus far has been the stage of disillusionment. Why? Because quite simply, it was the time when my illusions were removed. I started off saying, that'd be good, that's something I can do. I know how people are, yeah, no worries. And then they said, okay, put on this badge. And as I did the training at Royal Perth Hospital, and today you're a chaplain, you're enter the ward, and all of a sudden I realised with a thud that I wasn't going to be able to rely on myself. it wasn't my level of ability that was at question here. It was the level to which I relied on God. And at that point, feeling quite undone, I realised the only way to proceed was to hold that God was sufficient, not me. And it was at that time that I truly understood my role to be one of carefully making myself present whilst carefully staying out of the way, if you can do both at the same time, so that God could have God's way rather than Ken having Ken's way. That's basically what it is for me and how it feels to be a chaplain. Something that I do in my role is I administer a program called Second Step Employment. And I've got just a short video to show you about that, just to go from my thoughts and feelings into some of the on-the-ground work that I do. So if you're happy, I'll show that. It'll last 12 minutes, and then if there are any questions, we can do that, or just have a cuppa. Video. Need some volume, huh?
Sound.
You unplugged it, did you?
Just hang on a second.
Press pause.
Just press pause, go back to the end. Sorry. It's alright. There in a sec. This might blink things out.
Yep, that works. This is a bit of a corporate video, so excuse the genre, but it'll give you the same information.
I think that message that is really important here is that what we've done hasn't cost us a lot. It's required a bit of effort, sure, but most organisations, I think, have put their mind to do some other things, and so whilst it's personally satisfying, and Ruth Ogden, who runs this campaign inside, and runs this campaign inside as well, I'm sure is still working day and night, and she would say it's probably a lot harder than it may look. But if you're an organisation, you allocate some far outweigh the effort required to put it